From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next hour and a half as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode number 40 of Little Brother, dated the 6th of April, 2002. Stay tuned, Little Brother's right round the corner. And before we get started, I need to remind you, as always, that the opinions and views expressed in this show are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, the WRPI staff or management, or the Rensselaer Student Union. Responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal. And if you'd like to throw in your 2 cents worth, please feel free to do so. The number here at WRPI is area code 518-276-6248. That number again is 518-276-6248. And if you want to send me an email, you can do that also. My email address is critter@verizoneatspoop.com. That's critter, C-R-I-T-T-E-R, at verizoneatspoop, all one word, .com. And last but not least, you can send me snail mail. My snail mail address is Chuck Ritter, care of WRPI, 1 WRPI Plaza, Box 31, Troy, New York, 12180. That address again, Chuck Ritter, care of WRPI, 1 WRPI Plaza, Box 31, Troy, New York, 12180. So let's get started. We're going to probably mostly concentrate on the Risks Digest today. If you hear one of these things and it interests you, even if I've moved on to another thing, please, as I've said before, feel free to give a call in. The number here is 518-276-6248. I don't care if the topic is past. Bring it up, and I will gladly talk to you about it. As usual, we're going to go with the items from the Risks Digest to start with. And the first item that we have was an open letter to the global internet community on the topic of overcoming ICANN. Now, for those of you who are not familiar with ICANN, ICANN is the Internet Committee on Assigned Names and Numbers. Now, these are the folks who are primarily responsible for taking and assigning a 32-bit number to a computer or a group of these 32-bit numbers. These are called IP addresses. And making sure that every one of them that is out there on the internet as a whole is unique. So that if I punch in 2482.96.23, I'm going to get the computer I wanted instead of some computer halfway around the globe from the one that I wanted, because that number is unique. At any rate, this is, like I said, an open letter from the People for the Internet Responsibility. And they say, despite its best efforts, the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers has proven overall to be a failed experiment in internet policy development, implementation, and management. ICANN's lack of meaningful representation and its continuing pattern of drastic and seemingly arbitrary structural and policy changes, amongst other shortcomings, have created an unstable and suspicion-ridden environment around the world. The resulting overly politicized situation not only threatens the stability of the Internet itself, but also invites drastic and undesirable interventions by a variety of vested interests. We will not, in this document, detail the range of specific problems and issues which have become widely recognized and known. Key aspects of the problem relating to the Internet and ICANN have been outlined in previous statements, along with a set of basic proposed Internet guiding principles. The continuing rapid deterioration relating to ICANN and its impact on the Internet now forces us to recommend the following three actions. First, as an immediate temporary measure, all internet policy, operational, and other internet-related functions currently performed by ICANN should be transferred as soon as practicable, while maintaining continuity, to a different already existing nonprofit organization or organizations on a non-permanent, strictly stewardship basis. One potential candidate that we would like to suggest considering for this role would be the Internet Architecture Board, or IAB, although there are a range of other possibilities, of course. The process to plan and begin a transfer of responsibilities from ICANN should be initiated immediately. Next, we recommend that an intensive international study be started at once with a mandate to propose detailed and meaningful paths for the Internet's development, organizations, and management. The goal of this study would be to help guide the formation of the purpose-built representative organizations and policies that would be beneficial both to the established Internet stakeholders and to the wide variety of organizations and individuals who are effectively disenfranchised in the current Internet policy environment. This study should consider both short-term and long-term alternatives and could potentially be conducted by the National Research Council and related international organizations, among other possible frameworks. Our third recommended step would be for the results of the study to be carefully considered and, as deemed appropriate, to be implemented. Internet-related functions would be transferred from the temporary stewardship organizations to the entities developed from the study results. Time is definitely of the essence if a potential meltdown of Internet policies, functionalities, and operations in the near future is to be depoliticizing the situation and providing opportunities for consensus building regarding the range of Internet issues. Wide consensus has already been achieved on at least one key point. Even by ICANN's current president, ICANN is seriously broken. We agree, and we additionally assert that ICANN's history, structure, and behaviors strongly indicate that the most productive course would be for ICANN's role in the Internet affairs to be discontinued. This is not to cast aspersions to the efforts of any individuals involved with ICANN in the past or present. Rather, we feel ICANN has failed as an organization, and the amount of bad blood and institutional baggage it carries doom reform efforts with the organization itself to ineffectiveness at best. We come to this conclusion reluctantly, since in the past we've considered that there might be an appropriate continuing role of some sort for ICANN. Unfortunately, this is no longer possible. We do not have all of the answers regarding Internet issues, and nobody does. The proposals above are not presented as a kind of fait accompli, but rather an attempt to stimulate recognition that the Internet is facing serious problems that are in need of serious solutions. The search for solutions will be difficult, and it will be a continuing effort that far transcends matters currently relating to ICANN. But half measures will no longer suffice, and the status quo, however it may be disguised or spun, can no longer be tolerated. Some people genuinely fear that alternatives to ICANN might lead to situations even worse than the current dysfunctional ICANN environment. That is indeed a non-zero probability, but the increasingly chaotic situation within ICANN makes degeneration a decided likelihood if ICANN remains involved with the Internet matters. The day of reckoning is already upon us. Work should begin immediately to define and implement collaborative processes that can provide hope of assuring that the Internet will be the best possible resource for the population of the entire world. The risks in charge and change are real, but the need for change and the possibilities for meaningful and beneficial progress are even greater. If we do not take these steps, we may well be dooming the Internet to a future of mediocrity at best, or of decay, fragmentation, greed, and even worse, outrages. And of course, this was signed by David J. Farber, representing the People for, what was it called again? The People for Internet Responsibility, or PFIR. And they have some additional links on here. Go to www.pfir.org/statements/policies and www.pfir.org/statements/proposal for information on the Internet policies and control and proposal for a representative global Internet policy organization. And also you can see their PFIR principles at www.pfir.org/principles. Straightforward enough. Anyway, let's move on to something that's perhaps a little bit more close to home. Many of us have got friends, acquaintances, family, etc., who are involved in the military. Oh, hey, we have a call. Let's see what we have here. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
This is Fong.
Hey, Fong, how are you doing?
Bugaboo. I was a bit confused because does ICANN actually, do they actually negotiate the doling out of IP addresses as well as, I thought it was just
it's domain name. It's my understanding that they do, because somebody has to be in charge of ensuring that an IP address is unique in the world.
What about Aaron?
Yes, I think you're, actually, now that you mentioned that, I think I was mistaken about that.
Or do they sub-delegate that responsibility? But what's the name of this group that's making
the
this proposal?
The People for Internet Responsibility, PFIR.
Now, I mean, nobody's denying that, but I was trying to, in what they said, I was waiting to hear some actual anecdotes. I don't know. Are you familiar with any, you know, they claim that some of the actions of ICANN have been kind of arbitrary, but, I mean, I can think of one off the top of my head, but are you familiar with any of the actions that have been questioned?
I don't have them. If you have one, I'd love to hear it, though. I thought there were going to be in this article as I read it, and I was kind of disappointed that they were not there. So I will dig them up and bring them with me next week because I think it's important. But if you have an anecdotal story about it, I'd love to hear it.
Well, being your friendly neighborhood name server administrator, I thought one that comes to mind is the new top-level domains. I mean, nothing's more arbitrary than .museum and .arrow, which are still in the works, but they are coming. I mean, I don't know what the actual situation was, but nothing, you know, the only thing that comes to mind is, you know, the highest lobbyist to ICANN was the winner there, because, I mean, if you're going to use any kind of common sense to organization of new TLDs, I think .museum and .arrow is a bit, I don't know, too niche for my taste.
What was the last one there? Is it .ero or .aero?
.aero, and this is for the airline industry, for airports, airlines, but we're just, I don't know, that we're just going to exclude other forms of transportation in widespread use and let them stick to .com.
That is an interesting point because last I checked, airlines were commercial and museums are usually or nonprofits.
Yeah.
So both would neatly fall under .com and .org respectively.
Yeah, but I mean, it's fine to further segment the namespace, but how about something a little more logical like .trans for transportation? You know, we're going to exclude Greyhound and Amtrak. And, you know, someone in the airline industry decided, oh, we need our own TLD for some reason, and they had the money to push for it, and that would be my guess.
You know, what I think would probably be a fair solution, although I know that absolutely nobody would go for it, would be if they were to adopt a second level domain. So you had, for example, .arrow.com, .museum.org, or .museum.edu.
Yeah.
You know, I think a museum, actually, if you put museums under edu, makes more sense because some are profit and some are nonprofit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you put them under .edu, it covers it because they're all about education.
Mm-hmm.
So you'd have .museum.edu. But the problem is, the problem is that as things stand now, people have just gotten so used to the idea of being able to put the company name .com and get there that would just never fly, and consequently nobody would ever subscribe to those second level domains.
Yeah.
So new top level domains, unfortunately, looks like the solution.
I'm waiting for AnnMurray.museum.
Yeah, why is that?
Well, of course, for Ann Murray's own museum in Nova Scotia.
Right.
I don't know. A colleague of mine, we're proposing our own suggestion for a new TLD. That sucks. You know,
well, that's already,
I mean, it makes sense. Like, critique a whole TLD for critique for criticism on the web, of course.
I love it. I love it.
Of course, Verizon would be the first to make a purchase there, I'm sure.
Yeah, I think. Well, here's what you do about that. You know, you have somebody come along and get the second level domain really.sucks.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that would solve that problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because then the people who were administering really.sucks. Okay. Yeah, ICANN has to be has to at least maintain an appearance of being impartial. So they wouldn't be able to decide at least not for very long without getting without getting some pressure brought to bear on them who can and who cannot get a .sucks domain if they were to introduce that as a top level domain.
Yeah.
What would then happen is you'd have somebody come in and get really.sucks, but there's no reason why that person has to be impartial. You know, they could ensure that that the person who in turn registered Verizon.really.sucks would genuinely be interested in expressing opinions about Verizon.
Well, that my colleague, one further note that my colleague suggested was, this is actually Mekno, who was on the show a few weeks ago, but he suggested that perhaps inverse to other domain dispute policies, the .sucks domain could not be registered by the holder of that registered trademark.
Interesting idea. But you know what would happen then is they'd just go and they'd either form partnerships and buy each other's .sucks domains, or they would just spin off a subsidiary, and the subsidiary would buy it.
Yeah, it's actually a big week for domain name news. One other thing I thought of, it's the recently this year the .us domain became commercialized. A company called Neustar was granted a trial period in managing the .us TLD, they've kind of put suspensions on registration of .us domains. But this week pre-registrations began. So I'm imagining all of the possible bastardizations of the United States TLD, like a special moment dot for dot us.
Or something like that, yeah. It's kind of like these Tonganese top-level domains you see, dot T-O,
yeah.
Where you see welcome dot T-O.
Mm.
And the people that own that one then in turn give you a forwarding based on what you enter for a path after the node name there. So, like, for example, you'd go welcome.to/ and, I don't know, radio or whatever you might be interested in.
Or, you know, for instance, WRPI might get listen.to/WRPI.
Yes, you got exactly the right idea.
Yeah.
You know, you got exactly the right idea there. Now, here's a question I would have to wonder about is this. If .museum mm-hmm. is going to be one of the new accepted top-level domains,
mm.
I have a friend who operates a website, and the website is called N2TJQ's Radio Museum.
A virtual museum.
For ham radio. It's a virtual museum. Would he be eligible to get N2TJQ.museum?
Mm.
That's the question that I would have to ask about that. Is a virtual museum eligible for a .museum domain name?
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I'd love to hear the answer to and love to hear the justifications for, because I could see this one going either way.
Or how about shrines? Like if I think my bedroom is like a shrine to Elvis, could I get Elvis.museum?
Good question.
Or how about Elvis freak.museum at least?
Hey, actually, you know, that just gave me a thought for something that somebody may want to register for a Tonganese top-level domain, or not top-level, but for a Tonganese domain, if it hasn't already been done, would be shrine.to.
Hmm.
Hmm. Yeah, there's
oh,
a thought
shrine
for you.
To...
Yeah. Like, for example, in your case, as you were just saying, shrine.to/Elvis.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So, what else is going on in the world of domains?
Well, let's see. I have this stuff that you sent me here, where we're talking about protections that are put in place of in place on the top level domain servers. However, I think before I begin this story, I think a little bit change in the music may be appropriate.
Oh, no.
Okay. We got the James Bond theme going here. Squatting unobtrusively on the banks of a man-made pond in an unremarkable corporate subdivision a few miles outside the Beltway, the home of the Internet's authoritative root server and master registry of .com addresses, virtually indistinguishable from the other red brick office buildings that surround it. Despite its humdrum facade, VeriSign's Network Operations Center is one of the most important physical locations in the internet and the virtual world, and since September 11th, it has proven irresistible to dozens of government officials who have sought to assure themselves that the internet is, safe from physical and electronic attacks. Security and stability are like Siamese twins. You cannot have stability without security, said Mark Ripp, Vice President of Technical Operations for VeriSign Global Registry Services. If people can come and mess with your system... One way or another, you have no control over your systems. Our primary function is the stability of the global internet. Obscurity is the first line of defense. The building is unmarked, its address unspecified in company literature, and its managers tight-lipped about disclosing driving directions or identifying markings to strangers. While the location of the building is not a true secret, dozens, if not hundreds, of internet addressing insiders know where it is. It would be difficult for a casual vandal or criminal to stumble across it. Visitors start with a stroll through a metal detector and past a guard desk, much as they would in any moderately secure office building. They take an elevator to the top floor, where the security is the tightest and inconspicuous cameras monitor the hallways. The few entrances to the operations center and server rooms can only be reached through antechambers called man-traps, which are outfitted with scanners that read unique contours of the visitor's palms. If an unauthorized visitor places his hand in the scanner, it triggers a lockdown, sealing the intruder in one of the narrow, wood-paneled closets, until security forces arrive to remove him. Oh, good grief. What torture. Wood panel?
Well, better than the glass blocks, I guess, suppose.
I suppose so. There was some...
Or being encased in ice a la Superman's North Pole retreat.
Oh, yes. The, what is that called? Fortress of Solitude.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. Now, I had seen I had seen one of these man traps, actually, not the one that's protecting the not one of the ones that's protecting the A root server, but actually one that was protecting a credit card company. A job I had a few years ago had brought me in to do some server work for them, and it's intriguing. Now, the one they had was just a made out of bulletproof glass, so you could see all the way around you when you were inside the thing. It had a bunch of little pressure sensors down on the floor that would basically count the number of feet in the man trap. And if there were more than 2 feet, it would not close the door to the outside before, you know, it just wouldn't
let
you in. It
would start playing, like, funky soul music. Get them in the mood.
Well, I mean, the idea is to prevent tailgaters, you know?
Uh-huh.
And, It's intriguing to see the measures that they go to, and I've heard of places that are even higher security than that, where there are workplaces where they weigh you on the way in and on the way out every time, and you'd better not weigh any different one way or the other, or you'd better have a good explanation for why. You know, it's kind of like it kind of reminds me of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. There's a brief discussion of a planet in there called Beth Seligman, where they're so concerned about the cumulative erosion caused by caused by millions of visiting tourists every year, and that for this reason, any net imbalance between the amount you eat and the amount you excrete while you're on the planet is surgically removed from you when you leave. So when you use the toilet, you have to get a receipt.
So, for those not in the know, the A root servers are the primary out of, I think, about 8 servers out there that...
It's 8 or 9, somewhere in that general vicinity.
They begin the hierarchy of the domain name system that allows us to navigate the internet by human-type names, such as .com and .net, rather than having to use numeric IP addresses.
Yeah, they're a tremendous time saver, and the fact of the matter is the way the internet is structured in this day and age, they get used so intensely that if the domain name system were to be knocked out, effectively the internet would be knocked out.
Mm-hmm.
It's
a far cry from the modest origin of the name system back in the ARPANET days, where there was a small, maybe a couple hundred K file called host that was just manually traded around maybe twice a week. And that's how people resolved names to their corresponding IP addresses. But in the .com era, such a centralized way of doing things would not suffice. So we have these various servers throughout the world that provide... the information about, well, at least the initial information about where, what .com, .net, and all the other associated TLDs resolve to and where they reside. So basically we're talking about the server that controls.
It basically runs the net.
Yeah.
I need to stop you for a second here and say WRPI, Troy. Just
you said that quite eloquently.
Just one of those things that we have to do to keep the FCC happy.
Mm.
And of course, we don't want them upset at us. They're
are we complete with that story?
I think we may be. However, we're up to the point where I need to probably take a minute and talk about what's going on after dark in the Capital District. And as usual, things around the studio here are a shade on the disorganized side.
Well, I know.
So, if you wanted to start with another story, by all means.
Well,
and I'll see if I can find some stuff.
I can tell you. I know tonight at. Let's see. I know tonight at Power Company in Albany, there's some house music and that ilk going on.
Mm-hmm.
That's a small club in Albany.
Well, I do have a list of some things that are going on here that I can talk about. These are things that are going on at the Van Dyke, and. For those of you not familiar with it, it's in Schenectady, and it's quite a pleasant place. Tonight, they have the Joe Barna Quintet, an energy-packed, hard-driving young group of musicians playing traditional hard-bop standards. Group consists of Albany area natives. Let's see, Joe Barna, and it doesn't say what he's on, and oh, I see what happened. It was printed from a web page. I hate when this happens. They printed it from a web page, and the right hand side of it's cut off, so I can't read the whole thing. However, Joe Barna Quintet, if you're familiar with them, are playing tonight at the Van Dyke. Tomorrow night it is Nick Brunola Tribute at 3 o'clock, and then again at 7. I guess only the 7 really counts because the 3 o'clock isn't after dark. At least not this time of year, it isn't. Let's see. Billy Cobham's Spectrum is playing on the 13th. I don't have a time for that show. Jefferson Starship Acoustic Explorer.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you thought and you thought Star Trek was the only one that had like endless spin-offs.
Yeah. let's see.
Could they get Jefferson Starship.Arrow?
I have no idea. Oh, here's one. April 20th at the Van Dyke, Antigone Rising is playing. I've seen these guys. These guys, well, I should say these ladies. These ladies understand rock. So if you like good, hard-driving rock, go see these girls. That's on April 20th at the Van Dyke.
At the Van Dyke.
Yep. Let's see.
Where's the Van Dyke?
The Van Dyke is in Schenectady. If you go up... if you go up Erie Boulevard in Schenectady, you can't miss it, really. Didn't know if you were, that's about all I can really say about it. If you go up Erie Boulevard in Schenectady, you really can't miss it. And there's only one direction to go up Erie Boulevard if you're coming in from I-890. So it's really difficult to miss. They have a very large sign.
Yeah, Unfortunately, I don't have the date on me, but I myself is excited because Gwar is coming to town at Saratoga Winners, I believe.
No kidding.
Are you familiar with them?
I've heard the name, but I haven't heard the music.
Yeah, well, it's also about seeing the spectacle. They're almost like B-movie monsters that play guitar.
Well, let me put it this way. I've heard them lumped in the same category as Survival Technology Labs, or rather used in the same sentence. So I would have to imagine the spectacle's got to be pretty interesting.
And messy. I can tell you that from first-hand experience.
Let me guess. You had front row seats, huh?
Yeah. So, I have an article. Well, it's not even really an article. It's more of a press release, but it refers to an incident that's worth discussing while we're on the subject of domains and domain registrations, and in this case, domain registrars. Let's see here. This is actually from GoDaddy.com. I don't know if you're familiar with them.
Another one I've heard, but not really had a chance to check out.
They're actually a competing registrar. About 2 years ago, the market for registering domain names was opened up to companies other than Network Solutions, who was the original company that had the contract for managing the doling out of domain names. So now you actually, I guess a good analogy is, imagine if you could go to alternate DMVs, like privately run DMVs, and you could go to the one that had the best, most courteous service to get your license renewed.
You can do that in Oklahoma.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
They call them tag agencies, but the idea is the same. Anyway, go on. I didn't mean to interrupt.
This is actually a press release from GoDaddy.com, which is actually one of the more popular alternate registrars. Most I will read popular, i.e. cheap. but they posted on their website recently, our response to the February 2002 issue of Consumer Reports magazine. Of course, you're familiar with the
Consumer Reports. Yeah, sure.
They write, you may know that the February 2002 issue of Consumer Reports magazine, or that in that magazine, GoDaddy Software, Inc. was mentioned under a column entitled Leaving a Bad Taste, which appeared on page 62. In that column, the writer talked about various marketers that are trying to take advantage of the September 11th disaster. In the middle of their column, they saw fit to display the GoDaddy logo with the following text. WTCDeathCount.com was coming soon when we visited. That address led to an ad for GoDaddy Software. This makes it look quite unfairly like GoDaddy is purposely using that terrible domain name to advertise its products. Nothing could be further from the truth. Here's what did happen. Each and every day, thousands of domain names are registered at GoDaddy. Registrations take place to an automated process and do so on an uncensored basis. This is as it should be, given that we live in a free country. Any name that is registered with us that is not associated with a website by its owner points to what we call a parked page that, among other things, contains our advertising. That's it, and that's all there is to it. GoDaddy Software did not register the name WTCDeathCount.com. GoDaddy doesn't own it. Some individual not affiliated with GoDaddy, for reasons we can't even begin to fathom, registered it using our automated registration service. However distasteful the name may be, and we certainly think it is distasteful, it breaks no laws, and the individual who registered it is entitled to the name. Until we read the mention in Consumer Reports magazine, we were not even aware that the name was registered through us, or for that matter, existed at all. Consumer Reports, by the way, didn't bother to call us, didn't bother to ask what the situation was, didn't ask us for a response, none of that. They were far more interested in simply reporting something negative about somebody. And for this, they set their sights on GoDaddy. Regarding patriotism, please know that all of us here at GoDaddy are proud to be Americans and love our country. I personally fought as a combat rifleman with the 26th Marines in Vietnam. I received the Combat Action Ribbon and Purple Heart Medal, among other decorations. After September 11th, GoDaddy was one of the very first companies in our great country to rush forward with a significant cash contribution for the American Red Cross. We were also among the first to voice our support for our president and for everyone victimized by and for those responsible for dealing with that terrible situation.
Well, if I can jump in on that one for a second, the point that I would make is, looks to me like... In fact, GoDaddy is upholding that most important of all American principles, freedom of speech, in not bringing forth any sort of a fuss when somebody did, in fact, want to register such a tasteless domain name as WTCDeathCount.com or something like that. Yeah. I agree with him. I cannot fathom why somebody would want to register a domain name such as that, but you know, it's supposed to be a free country, so I don't see any reason why they should be stopped from doing it.
And I think they're even going as far as making an assumption about the registrant of that domain, because I'm sure you're familiar with tons of cases where people or groups will register distasteful domains for the only motive of keeping it out of the hands of those that might like to use it for hateful reasons. I mean, we have someone here that bought and did nothing more than park a domain. I mean, we've seen a good example might be, this isn't the case, but let's say an anti-hate group registering KKK.com.
Right.
So that... the Ku Klux Klan can't actually use that domain and just leave it parked and therefore inert.
Right.
We have no more evidence. We have no evidence that of the intention of the registrant either. So I think this is a horrible case of gross assumption. And in fact, I'm very disappointed in Consumer Reports, because I'd say right alongside the Better Business Bureau, they're recognized as almost a de facto institution of consumer protection.
Right, exactly.
And they went out on a limb completely and reported on a product that they obviously know nothing about and did no research on in terms of the way it works before printing, this almost libelous comment.
Exactly. I want to also make a quick comment here, and that is that anybody out there listening, if you would like to throw in your 2 cents worth, please feel free to do so. The phone number here is area code 518-276-6248. My name is Chuck Ritter. Fongaboo is joining me by telephone.
Mm-hmm.
And Chuck, I'm not obstructing anyone, but yeah.
No, not at all.
Talking to you on this line.
Not at all. We can always, we can double them up. That's not an issue. So. Well, I have another one here that, that you sent me. This was, another angle on, domain name registrations. Before I read this one, let me just bring up one other point around what you were just saying about parking domains.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes domains get parked for other reasons as well. The fine example and the one that I bring up every time somebody asks me about my email address, which by the way is critter@verizoneatspoop.com.
Mm-hmm.
And the origin of that is that somebody had gone to register the domain name verizonsucks.com, that person being, of course, Emmanuel Goldstein of 2600 fame.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to register verizonsucks.com only to find that it had already been registered.
Mm.
And he turned around and registered verizonreallysucks.com, which got him promptly sued by Verizon. He won, by the way.
Starting the first mudslinging fight of the internet name arena.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Well, I don't know if it was the first one, but it was certainly an interesting one because what his response was, he does a radio program as well and publishes a magazine, and he went on the air and in print and said, if you get an opportunity to register any domain name that contains the word Verizon that hasn't already been sucked up, do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I know other people besides yourself that have taken him up on that.
Yeah, well, actually, Verizon Eats Poop isn't even mine. It belongs to a friend that Goldstein and I have in common.
Oh, okay.
But
I had one last thing to throw in about the GoDaddy WTC discount.com situation. I was almost feeling inspired to reaction to that situation, but it was kind of funny because I think I had both an angel and a devil on respective shoulders. And as a name server admin, knowing ignorant and unfair the situation was, I wanted to write to Consumer Reports and criticize them for their action. But on the other hand, part of me considered registering WTCDeathCount.us and then writing to Consumer Reports and saying, see, they really do. And
Okay. Yeah, the U.S. The U.S. domain's got an interesting history to it, actually.
Yeah.
They decided to do something really stupid with it initially and make it logical.
Yeah.
The original, for the benefit of the listening audience, the original .us domain was based on geography. So, for example, if I wanted to take my organization here, C Cubed Studios, and put it on the internet, I might and use a .us domain. I would have to put it in these terms. It would end up being ccubed.schenectady.ny.us, and that's before you put a www in front of it. Similarly, if WRPI wanted a .us domain, it would have been wrpi.troy.ny.us. And the problem is that the addresses became so long that people are just unwilling to use them for the most part. And about the only folks that have actually continued to use them have been the folks that came up with them in the first place, that being government. So what goes on now... effective when? Is it effective yet? That they made the switch?
Oh, to commercial?
Mm-hmm.
No, pre-registration began this week. I think I don't know what the date is, but they still have to get approval from the Department of Commerce
okay.
For the end of their trial run before they can pull out new ones.
the nutshell of it is that at some point in the near future, they're going to change it around so that you can get, so that I would, for example, be able to get ccubed.us.
Yeah.
WRPI would be able to get WRPI.us, etc. Mm-hmm. Of course, why we'd want to, I'm not quite sure.
I could get don't F with us. Yeah. But, yeah, Neustar is the company that was designated control of the .us domain.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a few dealings with them as a name server administrator. And, I mean, it's questionable to say whether it's their fault or the people who mismanaged the domain prior to them coming control of it. But there's a lot of who's on first situations coming up. For instance, I was trying to get the name server delegation change for a given state.ny.us domain changed. And it was like town.soandso.ny.us. And they insisted that they couldn't authorize or enact the change. I had to contact the delegate manager of that domain, and they listed who they had on file as the delegate manager, and it was literally not even a name server administrator in any way, but the town supervisor about four terms prior. And I'm basically running the name server that's one below, you know, getting the direct delegation from them, but bureaucratically, I had to deal with, you know, Bob Roberts or whoever it was, who can't do anything anyway because he doesn't have a name server.
Yeah, okay. I could see how that would evolve.
Yeah.
Ouch.
So, and then there were also the some other non-geographical subdomains in .us. For each state, they typically, you'd find lib.state.us.
And,
fill in
and,
the state with the state of your choice, or k12.state.us.
And there was also the, for the state government, state dot, and I mean the word state here, dot, and then the state abbreviation .us.
That's true.
Like I said, these are the folks that have mostly kept, it. One of my friends has got an email address that ends in ogs.state.ny.us, for example.
Familiar.
Yeah.
Those are actually subdelegated to, in New York's case, PSINet.
Yes.
The original structure of it was, you know, a lot of these subdomains in .us were subdelegated out to volunteer organizations. My company is actually... technically, we're the registrar for k12.ct.us.
Mm-hmm.
So we've still been preserved that that power, so I don't know what they're going to be doing. Is they're going to be changing that in the future or what?
Cool. Well, so if we want to move on to another topic off of the off of domain service, there's an article that appeared in the Washington Post recently on the... No, I guess it wasn't recently. It says here it was November 22nd last year. But
is this one I gave you?
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
When domains go unrenewed, opportunists swoop in.
Hmm.
A link from Rod Morgan's church website has taken an unholy turn. The site, created by Morgan for his Rockville congregation, offered a link to the International Lutheran Women's Missionary League. But when the league changed its name and created a new web address, he said... the contact for its old address expired, or the contract, rather. Now visitors to the league's former site get a surprising pop-up, adults only, and then solicitation. This domain is for sale. And then a warning. Any offer under $550 U.S. will be ignored. Then a host of menu options that have nothing to do with religion. Imagine that. It's a pornographic site, said Morgan. I figure as names are lapsing, firms are looking at sites with particular associations and holding them for ransom, hoping that they will embarrass the original owners into buying them back for a huge sum of money. The church's experience is a new twist on an old theme. Since its infancy, the Internet has attracted cyber squatters who register domains such as McDonald's.com in bad faith, hoping that the rightful trademark owners will pay top dollar to get the names back. Cyber squatting was rampant a few years ago, but has slowed down after several squatters lost court cases over their right to register trademarked names. But these internet pornographers' opportunism could surge in the near future. A record number of .com, .org, and .net addresses are coming up for renewal or expiration. Of the 10 million names set to expire in the last half of this year alone, probably 5 million will not be renewed by the original owner, according to VeriSign, Inc., the California firm that oversees the master database of addresses. Once tough-to-get names will be back on the selling block, creating opportunities for speculators who have the technology to scoop them up within milliseconds of their expiration. Some internet analysts say the problem may take care of itself soon enough. Speculators driven by the visions of multi-million dollar sales of web addresses such as business.com, which fetched $7.5 million in 1999, no longer find an ultra-lucrative market after the .com bust, the analyst said. As a result, speculators are letting go of the web addresses they've been hoarding, said Craig Nankervis, I guess is his name, an analyst with First Analysis Securities. That helps explain why renewal of addresses at VeriSign, one of the larger domain name registration companies, dropped from 70% in the first quarter of this year to 60% in the second quarter and then 52% in the third, he said. We're finding that a lot of lower quality name holders are going away, said Nankervis. The whole speculative angle is sort of going down the drain, and we expect to see a lot of cleansing of the lower quality names bought in bulk. Also, given the declining interest in coughing up big bucks for web addresses, it's getting expensive for speculators, some of whom own thousands of names at a time, to hold on to their acquisitions, said Lori Whitted, VeriSign's vice president of marketing. But those factors may not be enough to put the kibosh on online opportunists who continue to vex local groups, including the Ballet Theater of Maryland. Interesting idea. Well, I'll tell you what, Fong, we're coming up on the we're coming up on the half hour. I'm going to take a quick moment for a break. Do you want to stay on and carry on into the next half hour, or
I'll check back with you. I guess your break's going to last
probably a couple of minutes. Yeah. So we'll I'll wait for you to call back, and I won't wait for you to call back. We'll just carry on, and we'll see you on the other side of the break.
All right.
You're listening to Little Brother on 91.9 FM WRPI in Troy.
This. Is WRPI Troy.
And it's jazz where it's at. Is where it's at.
This is a dangerous place.
Voices, he heard voices.
91.5 FM.
And you are listening to Little Brother on 91.5 FM, WRPI, Troy. Going into the last half hour here. And the phone number, if you'd like to give us a call, is 518-276-6248. That number again, 518-276-6248. Before we get back into it, I want to remind you that the opinions and views expressed in the show are strictly those of the participants, not necessarily those of the WRPI staff or management, Rensselaer Student Union, or Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and that responsible parties with an opposing viewpoint may request airtime for a rebuttal. Going to move off of the topic of domain names for a little bit here and go into one of my other favorite topics to beat up. That has to do with CD copy protection. And Yahoo News is reporting that Celine Dion's latest release is generating heated discussions on internet message boards. But the subject under fire is not the star's music. It is the CD that will not play on computer CD drives. Epic Sony released A New Day Has Come, embedded with the Key 2 audio copy protection in Germany and several other European countries. According to spokeswoman... According to a spokeswoman for Sony Music Entertainment, it is clearly stated on the front of the booklet and the back of the jewel box that the CD will not play on a PC or Mac in the language of the country in which it is sold. Besides these notices, which the spokeswoman said were readable before purchase, the disc itself bears the same warning. Should the consumer try to place Dion's CD on a PC or Macintosh, the computers likely will crash. Some fans believe that the CD is more damaging than that, however. On the German discussion boards at MacFixit, Mac users claim that the CD will not even eject using normal methods, that the intentional corruption of the disk's session could unpredictably affect the drive's firmware. Firmware is a combination of hardware and software instructions that are permanently embedded in the hardware's controlling chips, such as with a computer's CD-ROM, and altering it could cause permanent damage. Sony denied these allegations. The CD will probably cause the system to crash, but it will not alter anything, the spokeswoman said. And it won't eject properly, but that's just because the computer has crashed. New Day was released in the United States on Tuesday, and industry watchers expect it to sell more than 500,000 copies by the end of its first week. More than 10 million discs using the Key 2 Audio CD copy protection scheme have been produced and sold primarily in Europe. Key 2 Audio is a product of Sony DADC, a 100% affiliate of Sony Corporation of America, headquartered in Austria. Interesting. A Japanese company with headquarters in Austria, and it's an American organization. I don't get it. Okay. Let me see here. Since I was not able to do a show on the weekend of April 1st, I'm going to cover a couple of things that were of interest to that date. However, we'll come back to that in just a moment. Need to take care of a quick little bit of business, and we'll be right back. Okay, you are listening to 91.5 FM WRPI in Troy. Steve has just arrived. He's going to be doing the next show. However, seems to have expressed an interest in the topic at hand. So let's bring one of the guest mics up. Go ahead. Have a seat and let's.
I was just about to set up my laptop. I guess I can put it off for a few moments. But it actually really is a very hot topic. Among those in the internet, a lot of people are just, you know, again, using this as an excuse to bash the RIAA.
They need a good bashing, though.
They do. Because really, they just don't get it. You know, first with the Napster thing, the whole point was that... the whole point of Napster was that people was able to listen to music that they were never able to listen to before. And ironically, CD sales were actually boosted because of Napster, because of people able, you know, they're able to listen to new stuff. And if they like the stuff enough, they will buy the CD. Obviously, it will hurt sales for artists such as, you know, for main artists such as Britney Spears or Celine Dion, I think, because a lot of people buy their CDs. Not necessarily for, I'm probably going to sound really bad for saying this, but not necessarily because they really, really like the music. But you know, because it's popular,
it's an unfortunate sort of trend, but you're right.
And those are the kinds of people who are going to download the song and not bother to buy the CD. Ooh, free stuff, you know, that sort of mentality. But overall, I think it was better for Napster to be here, and it's not too much of a loss. There's still other places where you can definitely find that music.
There was actually an interesting thing said a couple of weeks ago. I don't remember where the original site was. I had found it on Slashdot. There was an article expounding that the RIAA has now seen a drop in sales. But
yes,
the problem is that they now do not have Napster to kick around for it. And the reason is the demise of Napster caused
now
the drop
they're kicking
in sales.
On other stuff. They're kicking on other things like radio streaming. I'm sure you know about that.
Yes.
And I'm sure you talked about it frequently on the show. Have
unfortunately,
you?
I have not.
Ah, well, that's but, hey, next show then. What
I,
do you know?
I think it is. I think it is. I have I have such a long list of topics I want to cover, and
there's
I only
so
have,
much.
There's only so much you can put in an hour and a half.
Yeah, there's so much cred out there that, you know. Well, anyway, back on the topic of CD protecting, a lot, you know, the really bad thing about this is that a lot of people want to get the most out of their CDs. And for several CDs, what they've been doing was, without actually marking the CD, that to tell consumers that you could not play it in your laptop or your computer or your PC or Mac, whatever, that you cannot play it in there, and people were getting very upset because they were buying the CD with the intent of, oh, I want to listen to it at home, you know, with my surround sound system, but I also want to listen to it at work. So what they want to do is they either, you know, play it at their in their computers at work, or they want to rip it to MP3 so that they can listen to it at work. Ooh, like this, I assume.
I have a CD based MP3 player.
Ah, yes.
And
see, I tried buying one of those things, except it kept on skipping on the higher bitrate songs.
Actually, I'll tell you, I haven't had a problem with the skipping so much on the higher bitrate songs when using it, you know, carrying it. When putting it in the car, however, the vibration appears to be just exactly right that it's a problem.
Well, that's different.
But it skips, like, easily
yeah.
10 times worse when you're playing a standard audio CD in it.
Yeah. Well, wow, really?
Really?
Interesting. Well, the one that I had was really bad. I would just sit down. Yeah, like it's skipping now.
Well, this is just an ordinary audio CD, but let me just give it a kick here. We'll just skip ahead to the next track and see how it goes.
Yeah, this is nice background music.
Hey, thanks.
Very simple, you know, and it really goes along with the,
with
I don't
the technical
know. Well, thing. I don't know. Maybe I'm just rambling again. But
that's all right. I've been using this style of background music for the entire time I've been doing this show.
Wow.
But now let me look at it this way. You're talking about you're getting ready to do your show, and you're talking about setting up your laptop computer.
Yeah.
Presumably, your laptop computer contains the music you intend to play tonight.
Well, not all of it. See, the thing is that I find a lot of music that is not published.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing I have against the big record companies, is that they won't really, you know, publish anyone who they don't think will sell. But there is so many awesome artists out there that do not have record contracts that you can find online that are so awesome. Of course, you have to sort through the riffraff, of course.
I'm going to I'll tell you something on the I'm going to end my show on with a track from a band called Red Letter Day.
Uh-huh.
Local band that is in exactly that situation.
Yep.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, no problem. Well, actually, like a bunch of my show, I'm going to do that. In fact, I looked through some of my older MP3s and I noticed that I had a lot of ambient drum and bass. So, by underground artists. So what I did was I took my brand spanking new Acid 3 program that I bought for way too much money. don't even let me get started on that. That's just wow. I originally intended it so that I could, you know, write music again, because I have written music in the past. Just try to get it going again. But the thing is that it makes it ludicrously easy to mix music.
Absolutely.
Because it's got this beat mapping wizard, and it just gets the beat mapping on, like, completely on. I mean, it really makes me have respect for the people who can really do this in real life. Because they make it way too easy, and I think you're gonna see a lot of cheesy mixes
in
the future.
I know exactly what you mean by people who do it real time. There's Mr. Always was on right before me, and I was just towards the last 10 minutes of his show, I was just kind of standing there watching him work his wizardry, and it's really cool to watch, because you look at it and you see.
Yeah.
You see he's simply, you know, spinning the record this way, spinning it that way, and it just makes it look so easy.
Yeah, they do. And then scratching does look amazingly easy. I've tried it. It's not. It is not easy. It takes practice.
Yes, it does.
So I definitely, if you have the chance, try to get somebody to show you how to scratch. It'll give you a lot more respect for what they do.
This
is interesting. All the sirens and stuff. Old school.
Yeah, it is. This is old school
rave music, right?
This is all exactly what it is.
Yeah.
Exactly what it is. These all of these tracks came off of the AmiNet site.
Uh-huh.
Their stuff that was originally composed on Amiga computers back in the in the late 80s and early 90s.
Ooh. Now the interesting thing about that is that if you go to mp3.com and surf the top 40 of the electronic genre,
yes,
you will see 10 years later, after the 80s, you will see people making songs like this, perhaps not even as good, claiming it as brand new stuff, stuff that rocks, you know, and just throwing a few cheesy misspelled words, you know, here and there, and
yeah,
there you have it.
D00DZ.
Oh, dudes. Yeah. Dude, check this out. It's so elite, man. Definitely. Yeah. So, wait, I was talking about copy protection on CDs, and I don't think I even finished that.
But it seems to me like, you know, you're talking about putting your music on your laptop computer, bringing it in here, and it seems like putting copy protection on a CD would stand right firmly in your way. Of taking and airing material.
Not exactly, because you've got the CD players here. I mean, they work on normal CD players, that's fine. What it doesn't allow you to do is it doesn't allow you to get the most out of a CD.
Bingo.
And for that reason, a lot of people are pissed. Are very mad. Yeah, that was
okay.
A no-no,
you can,
I'm sorry.
actually, that's that hasn't been a no-no for about 8 years.
Really?
Yeah.
So if you add ED on the end, it's okay?
No, actually, the reason why that word was set loose was because of a Nirvana song.
Ah.
But
well, I guess I have to like Nirvana now. Yeah, they're good. It's just not my style.
Right, I understand.
So I'm sort of, you know, out on a limb on that topic.
That's all right.
So, well, I've heard of several methods of copy protecting CDs. Like one, you know, has to do with, you know, specific software or whatnot that's supposed to interact with your computer so that it doesn't play right or something. But people are worried that people are just going to crack it, right?
Actually, I'll tell you something that there are some folks have already managed to crack it.
Not surprised.
In actuality, it took no effort. There's a they do it by messing up the integrity of the data contained on the CD.
That's the other method I was going to talk about. This is what really gets me mad. They introduce intentional errors and they're making it so that your CD player is dependent. You know, CD players have automatic error correction.
Right, exactly.
And apparently computer CDs don't. I guess because computer CDs, like, read more perfectly or something.
Allegedly.
Or something like that.
It just doesn't work that way, but yeah.
But anyway, they're introducing actual errors into the CD tracks, and they're making it so that you have to depend on your CD player to not screw up.
Now, here's the interesting thing.
I'm really pissed. We're really mad.
for those of us who are not in the Microsoft world, I am a Linux user.
Ah, good for you.
And
unfortunately, I have to rely on Microsoft.
We have a program for ripping CDs, which basically emulates a super paranoid CD player.
Wow.
So it does all kinds of backtracking and rechecking and error correcting. And
That's good. That's and, good. I've downloaded too many MP3s with blips in them.
And within a week of these error-ridden audio CDs coming out, somebody made the announcement, hey, CD paranoia can still rip them.
Nice. Yeah, see, I just think it's a lot of wasted energy. Instead of trying to go against the flow of technology and instead of, you know, trying to block free access of information, because most people out there aren't just in the free stuff mentality. A lot of people actually respect a lot of these artists and do feel like, you know, supporting them, buying the album. I mean, whenever I hear something I really like, I usually buy the album.
Exactly.
So, you know, unless if I, for example, can't buy the album. Like, there's a lot of underground stuff that I can't buy the album for.
Well, and then by the same token, you also have, lost my train of thought. Never mind.
That's okay. I've done that.
Oh, I hate when that happens,
especially
though.
Especially
I'm starting
to show
my age.
Yeah.
So, anyway.
Well, that's okay, because I kind of... Well, you know, they call those things senior moments.
Yes, exactly.
Well, I prefer to call it cluelessness because it happens to me too often.
Fair enough.
So.
Well, I'll tell you a piece of advice my dad offered quite a lot was he said there are three things that go when you get old. The first one is your memory. He never got around to telling, can never remember what the other two were.
Huh.
Anyway.
Yeah, that's a nice little joke.
Yeah.
So I actually, since it is like, what, eight, wait, oh yeah, that clock's a little slow, so it's 10 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Okay, 10 minutes until my show. I really want to start up my laptop and, you know, get that going.
Yeah,
and
go ahead, get yourself set up.
Because I've got CDs to look for, and great show, you know, keep doing what you're doing.
Hey, thanks.
I might listen more often. you know, I can't exactly vouch for my roommate at all, but we'll see.
Hey, whatever.
Yeah.
All right. Anyway, as I was saying, I was talking about how I was not able, unfortunately, to do anything on the April Fool's Day or April Fool's Weekend or anything like that. And there were a couple interesting items that showed up in the Risks Digest. And I'm going to preface this by jogging everybody's memory to please remember that these were published on April 1st. These are not serious. Okay. Well, you know, some people are humor impaired. You kind of have to jog their memory. You know, it's a joke.
How do you get me started on the aim.exe virus?
Right. So, anyway, here goes. The Department of the Treasury announced that this was on April 1st, announced today that responsibility for enforcement of new federal regulations on the software industry will fall under the jurisdiction of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. As the regulations come into effect, the Bureau will be renamed to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Software. The new regulations have been taken by most observers as a key indication of the federal government's serious concern over the software production scandal gripping the nation. The final verdict of the grand jury investigation into the dangers of unregulated software production was raised as a major victory by software leaders in Redmond last month. The grand jury investigation centered on the disturbing trend that key portions of the nation's critical infrastructure are being entrusted to a software product for which the secret inner workings known as source code are becoming as prevalent as pornography on the internet. The director of the ATF's 5,000-strong team of agents has pledged his full support to enforce the new regulations under which all software development must take place only on licensed facilities by trained individuals. He was joined at a press conference this morning by the director of the National Infrastructure Protection Center, who said, "It's about time the ATF took the entire software industry into its jurisdiction." He continued, "We would never consider laying the blueprints for our critical assets out for all to see. I applaud the new regulations for bringing sanity to a long unchecked industry. The public will have until June 1st, 2002, to dispose of all unregulated software products they may own. Possession of unlicensed software products can result in penalties up to 20 years in jail and multimillion dollar fines. Currently, only Smallsoft of Redmond, Washington has achieved the necessary regulatory status to produce software in compliance with the new regulations." An underground group of activists using the moniker the Electronic Frontier Foundation have been strongly critical of the federal government's position throughout. Police have indicated the violent clashes are expected between supporters of the EFF and the U.S. presidential nominee Billy Doors and the major proponent of the regulations as he addressed business leaders in Winnemucca, Nevada this afternoon. And the editor of the Risks Digest added a couple of quick comments. He says, "I suppose we can understand why they chose the acronym ATFS given alternatives such as FATS, AFTS, FAST, etc." Okay, now, I got a problem here. The problem is that this is really kind of scary how close this is to approaching reality. I don't expect the ATF to be the particular agency regulating software. However, I do see a problem with a regulation called the CBDTPA, and used to be called the SCCCA. I don't remember what I spat it right out a minute ago, and now I can't say it. But that regulation, I can't remember exactly what the expansion on that is. However, the SCCCA is the security certification, well, basically security systems security, I can't even think of that one, Certification Act. It basically requires that any piece of computer technology have certain locks in place in order to handle copy protection. In order to do this, the only way I can think of involves putting locks on the hardware in such a way that you have to have a key to work the hardware, and that the key would only be offered to those who make software that agrees to abide by copyright protection. Problem. Take an operating system like Linux, where the source is wide open and readily available, and all it would take would be somebody who has the certified version of Linux to go in and cut out the part that does the copyright protection without cutting out the part that unlocks the hardware, and wham, you have an illegal piece of software. Consequently, Linux can never be certified under this particular act. And I've said it in the past, and I'll say it once more, because I want to make sure that the entire world is perfectly clear on this point. In the event that Linux should ever become outlawed by this particular act, in other words, should this act become law, I pledge civil disobedience. I will continue to run Linux until they come to get me. Anyway, we have one more point I'm going to throw out here. Or one more article I'm going to throw out here. This is an old one. It's been floating around the internet forever. But, well, okay, maybe not forever. Maybe since 1995 or so. But it's worth going down anyway. At a recent computer exposition, Bill Gates reportedly compared the computer industry with the auto industry and stated that if General Motors had kept up with technology like the computer industry has, we would all be driving $25 cars that get 1,000 miles to the gallon. In response to Bill's comments, GM issued a press release stating that if General Motors had developed technology like Microsoft, we'd all be driving cars with the following characteristics. 1. For no reason whatsoever, your car would crash twice a day. 2. Every time they painted new lines on the road, you'd have to buy a new car. 3. Occasionally, your car would die on the freeway for no reason. You would have to pull over to the side of the road, close all the windows, shut off the car, restart it, and reopen the windows before you could continue. For some reason, you would simply accept this. 4. Occasionally executing a maneuver, such as a left turn, would cause your car to shut down and refuse to restart, in which case you would have to reinstall the engine. 5. Macintosh would make a car that was powered by the sun, was reliable, 5 times as fast, and twice as easy to drive, but would only run on 5% of the roads. 6. The oil, water, temperature, and alternator warning lights would all be replaced by a single general protection fault warning light. 7. The airbag system would ask, "Are you sure?" before deploying. 8. Occasionally, for no reason whatsoever, your car would lock you out and refuse to let you in until you simultaneously lifted the door handle, turned the key, and grabbed hold of the radio antenna. 9. Every time GM introduced a new car, car buyers would have to learn to drive all over again because none of the controls would operate in the same manner as the old car. And 10, you'd have to press the start button to turn the engine off. Anyway, I think we're going to wrap it up for this week. I'll see you next week. My name is Chuck Ritter. The show you've been listening to is called Little Brother. And, I don't know. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Yeah.